Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, our week in sports cars episode, the final one for 2018, but not the final forever. With me, as usual, my co-pilot, my higher conscience, the finest expression of a European sports car reporter, that would be...
Is it me? It's Brian Goodwin from, just in darkness now at the end of the evening in the UK. But great to be with you. And we're closing in, Marshall, on the first anniversary of this brave venture.
I know. We're a little over a month away from that. So we're going to do something different in that our show to close the year is part listener question, part listener award driven. Mm. We're also going to do one other thing. We try and hold our shows to an hour and a half. Sometimes they go over. We're actually going to downsize even more, and we're going to attempt to make this approximately 1 hour long. Why? Because it's December 28th, and this is the time we, and hopefully you, are relaxing, convalescing, charging your proverbial batteries to get ready for the new year. And since I am on a plane in 6 days to the roar before the 24 in Daytona, yes, we are going to have a compact show, but one that indeed celebrates you and your questions and your award. So, Mr. Goodwin, where shall we start as we attempt to rock and roll and get through as many as we can in 60 minutes?
It's going to be quick fire stuff. Jerry Robertson says, if you could build a race course anywhere in the world, including building a temporary street course, where would you build it and why?
My wife and I got married in Hawaii on the island of Maui, and I would say that it is so beautiful there. Granted, I realize that we would probably be adding pollution to that beautiful area, but I know the Hawaiian Super Prix, the legendary Hawaiian Super Prix that never happened in 1990, certainly hangs out there. I don't know if it would be a Super Prix, but it would be some form of proper road course where you obviously have the gorgeous mountains and the incredible ocean view there. Granted, it'd be some longer transport times, I guess, putting vehicles either on planes or boats to get there. But yeah, something in Maui, I think, Jerry. Come on. Yeah, we're pretty much paradise-type motorsports here.
Well, I'm going to run question two in with my answer to question one. Question two comes from Don Gregory. You'll get your moment at a moment, Don. But my answer is right here, right outside my front door. Why? Because I can, because you told me I can. And it means I don't have to travel. And it means I could actually, for once, share a motorsport event that I might be covering professionally with my girls, with my lady, and with my little one. So I'd do it at Epsom Downs. And anybody that knows my home will know that it's got plenty of rise and fall, plenty of challenging technical turns. I'm pretty certain I could put a decent track together, as long as the parked cars either side of the road could actually be moved on just for the day. It is where we are at the moment, very close to the home of another internationally famous event, the Epsom Derby, just down the road there. So there is a race course of sorts, albeit of the horse racing variety, but I'd do it here because I'm tired. I need not to get on a plane for a few weeks. We will see. Don Gregory, though, asked, you seem like you're able to juggle your personal lives with professional lives. Yes. I just became the father of twins, boy and girl. Congratulations, Don, in October. Can you give me a few tips that have helped you achieve a balance between work and home? Well, I'm afraid you failed at the first fence there, mate. There's nothing I can do for you now, twins. That's going to be, well, one, absolutely wonderful, but two, what a huge challenge, what a huge joy as well. How do you do it, MP? I think this is probably the last of these questions we're going to both answer. I do it by remembering when I'm home, I'm home.
Very fair. The other thing, Don, I can say, because I just counted them, I have 22 Post-its sitting in front of me on my desk, many of them piled on top of one another, along with many lists. So that helps keep my scattered mind at least from completely oozing out of my ears. The other thing, two other things very quickly. Yeah, balance. Boy, this is the wrong profession. And I would say having twins is probably going to throw you out of balance. So A, accepting that balance is not going to be your friend for a little while is one. And two, I would say the other thing is it just means longer hours. So the only way if you want to regain some balance is that getting up early part before your partner and or kids are up, or staying up later, etc. So at least for me, and we don't have kids, but to do what I do, and I'm sure what many other do in the sport, it's extending your day to handle some of the non-balance stuff separately, to maybe provide a semblance of balance when you are with family. Let's go to James Counter next. Graham, and this is all yours. What is the most stupid car name you've come across? I'm really hoping if Ferrari enter, quote, car, they'll choose something better than La Ferrari. I hope you two have a really great, well-deserved Christmas break.
Well, I think you've answered the question. The Ferrari La Ferrari, I think, goes down as an all-time stupid one. There have, of course, been some hilarious misses down through the years of car names that simply don't translate. The Vauxhall Chevy Nova, no go. Of course, in Spanish, the Rolls-Royce Silver Mist, which is actually the silver something unpleasant that came out your bottom, doesn't translate in German. And in similar fashion, the Toyota MR2 or MR2 or MERD, that doesn't translate well either. But the Ferrari LaFerrari, whoever came up with that one, needs what was once described to me as being a fat slap.
I will take the next one, Graham. This one comes in from Zling 111. Has there been a true AM that has risen up to the pro ranks? And has there been a person that did a day job and went into a pro entry? I don't know if this is a stretch, but I do think of him as the perfect fit for this. And that would be the late, great Al Hulbert, who is one of my heroes. This is a person who his father raced and such, but this is a person who grew up as a mechanic, as a gopher, working in the dealership. He had some great mentors. Mark Donahue is one of them. But I just think of the fact that Al was the winningest driver in IMSA history, was just the absolute epitome of IMSA's best. And this is someone who owned and ran the family Porsche dealership, formed and then ran what is today Porsche Motorsports North America. This is call him a businessman who spent the vast majority of his time each day either running businesses, managing racing teams, working on design and other concepts. The driving was almost secondary. And this is a person with multiple Le Mans wins, multiple Rolex 24 wins, multiple IMSA championships. Just, I think of Al and think of that as the perfect representation, Graham, of a man who did not come into the sport as a driver, learned, worked in the shop floor, worked his way up, had immense mentors, but truly had to balance that work race thing like no driver today had really has to consider, and to think that he essentially became IMSA's greatest, at least numerically, and also reputationally. Yeah, I'd put Al Hulbert there as the shining example.
Brilliant, brilliant answer, MP. Joseki 100 asks, will the amazing 720S debut at Golf 12 Hours help McLaren to get more customer teams? Loves the look of the car, wants to see it go race in every category. I think it remains to be seen. We know that Compass are going to be entering one of the cars in GTD in IMSA. I'm aware that there are other prospects still to emerge, but McLaren under no illusions that after the legal woes that rather put the brakes on things in customer motorsports for a little wee while, they've got some recovering to do. But you're absolutely right, it was a stunning debut for the 720S. Could have taken that win, and could have taken that win at a canter eventually, but hampered by a broken damper of all things after 10 hours of running. But I think we'll start to hear things in the very early new year about where you're going to see further examples of what is a very pretty GT3 car indeed.
Let's go to Judd Power, who says, as an early teenager, I was lucky enough to experience twin qualifying races on Friday night prior to the 2000 6 Hours of the Glen. The 18-lap points-paying races were held at dusk, one for the SR1, SR2, those being the prototype categories, and one for the GTO, GTU, American GT classes. And then in more recent years, it seems that the occasional change to the standard IMSA weekend format, 3 practices, 1 quali, 1 warm-up, and the race, has fallen by the wayside, at least for daytime races. Do you agree with keeping the weekend event schedules consistent, or would you like to see IMSA WEC ELMS spice things up a bit every now and then? Well, that's easy for me, Judd Power. I'm a big advocate of spicing things up. I think the only folks, by and large, who really, you know, are trying to think of the consistency, if we're talking weekend schedule, are those inside the series, whatever, all the various series that you mentioned. The reality is, while we would hope, Graham, that WEC fans get to more than one race per year, IMSA fans get to two or three, maybe. You know, the reality is someone who's rocking up for the 12 hours of Sebring might not be hopping on a plane and going all the way across the country to see IMSA at Monterey, for example. So if we're talking spicing things up, I think there's a mentality, Judd Power, that, oh, we have to keep things consistent, otherwise, quote, fans will be put off. Well, if we're talking about those who actually show up, the paying folks who are looking for entertainment, I don't think they'd know that. I don't want to say wouldn't know the difference, but I don't think they would care. I think the more you can incentivize, hey, come out to our race at wherever, VIR, we're going to do something a little fun and different this weekend. You know, media can be notoriously cranky about such things. Many of us are like cats. We don't like change. But to get to your question and answer, I don't care whether folks are uncomfortable or not. If there's something fun or cool that can be done, and it can be explained in a way where the fans in attendance and those watching through streaming or television can understand this new fun thing that they're going to do for, at different rounds, I'm all for it. I mean, truly, consistency is boring. It has its place if we're talking scheduling, right? Trying to go back to the same event at the same track each year in the same month or same time frame. I get that part. But once you get to the show, just think about fun. What can you do to bring more people in, make them happier? So completely agree.
Yeah, tend to agree with you, actually, just shaking things up. Next two we can run in together. It's a BH2EFR challenge. You're in charge of selecting one invitational entry for each of the following endurance races: 24 hours of Daytona, 12 hours of Sebring, 24 hours of Le Mans. Invitational entries shouldn't be legal in the series that you're invited into. It should be raced in another series, 2018-19. You get the teams and drivers that other series can add drivers, blah, 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 blah. Okay, we'll go with a simple part of this. And Grim Brother 1 says you get to select any other class of motorsport to join the usual suspects on the grid of the Le Mans 24 Hours. What class would you love to see mix it up with the rest of the field? Well,
I think we might choose the same one here, but go for it.
Well, I don't think you will. I don't think you will. I think what I'd like to see – I actually disagree with the question, with apologies. I think actually if you're going to have an invitational entry, you're either trying to prove something is more entertaining or you're trying to see how competitive it is. And I would actually like to see an automatic entry for the 24 Hours of Daytona from one of the significant entries in another championship with – similar cars, whether or not that be a GT3 car in GTD, whether or not that be GT E Pro or GTM in GTLM, whether or not they be LMP2 cars. I think that would be pretty cool. Of course, I'd like to see LMP1 cars around the oval. It's been quite some time since we saw that. Was it back in 2002? I think it was the
Something
last time
like
we saw
that. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the SR1 days, SR1 days. What would I like to see at the 24 Hours of Le Mans? A Formula One car. I'd like to see a Formula One car, and I think they're allowed to bring their entire pit crew. I think they're allowed to bring all their engineering support. I think they're allowed to do whatever they like with that car within the rules that it competes. They clearly can't change an engine. They clearly have to apply the same technical regulations, and then we'll see who's quickest, won't we?
Very simple. Japanese Super GT, GT500.
Fair enough.
Top five entries get entry at Le Mans just because it would be freaky. And they, if in theory, if there's five of them, then they could have their own class, their own race, and it wouldn't impede upon anything else. Let's see. Where shall we go? Ruslar. Thank you, Ruslar, for always sending in great stuff. Non-story of the year. Graham, we're merging into awards, right? Non-story
it's
of the year.
It's coming.
And
it's
we did
coming.
It. Yeah. Non-story of the year. Which news item got blown the farthest out of proportion, making it seem like a much bigger deal than it actually was?
Okay, let's go for this. I've been fairly loud on a number of occasions about people in areas of the sport taking sides where really they shouldn't be. And I'm going to go for Ford and Ferrari walk away from the table on Hypercar, a story which had absolutely no basis whatsoever, but actually did colour the views of a number of players for quite some considerable time, until it was the person who wrote that story had to go and apologise to Ferrari because it wasn't true. So I think the answer here is, I employ a kind of live and get let live thing to this. I think Hypercar has got massive pluses in terms of its potential. I think DPI has got massive pluses in terms of the consistency it gives and the survivability, if you like, that it gives, and the growth potential it gives to IMSA. And I think both can survive alongside each other. And I see absolutely no reason whatsoever to take sides. None whatsoever, indeed. So that, I think, for me, was the one that got blown furthest out of proportion and had some, albeit short-term, unfortunate effects in terms of people's outlook at a point where actually positivity was really important. So that would be my answer on that one.
I wonder if that's the person who made that apology is the same one who's going to have a bit of a rude awakening at next week's test. I'll just offer up the opposite very quickly, and we are trying to do one question, one answer, yep. But I'll just throw in Rooselaar. I'll go the opposite direction. The one that I felt was blown the least far out of proportion, one that actually deserved much greater investigation and uproar, and that was the Dempsey Proton Dempsey coding issue, which they got smacked for. I understand that, but I thought that one, I really thought that story would grow and linger and become a much bigger stain than it has been. So a little bit of maybe counter there. All right, well, let's jump fully into the awards here to close out the rest of the show, as we are just past 15, a little bit past 15 minutes in this one-hour episode. Bucksock, I'm not sure how to pronounce. Yeah, I love screen names. Best Pit Crew of the Year. I'll just simply say Corvette Racing, Graham Goodwin. They won a championship in IMSA. They won both the team's championship and they won the driver's championship on the driver's side with Magnussen and Garcia. They didn't win a single race, and that team stepped in to save that title when Antonio, someone who is near flawless, chucked the thing into the wall at Petit Le Mans, exiting pit lane on cold tires. Just, I mean, amazing. It still seems like a surreal event. Chucked that thing into the wall. The team made, what was it, 3 minutes or something silly to replace the entire front end of the car, effectively get it back out, turn the laps needed, and still deliver the driver's championship for those lads. It's almost, we could almost give it to them on a yearly basis, but I really thought that they closed the season with a perfect example of what makes them umpteen-time champions in everything that they do.
Excellent stuff. Next one is up from Opposite Lock, and he asked for a couple. I'm going to go for one of them. Embarrassment of the Year.
Me.
No. It's been far worse than that, much as that is difficult to believe and understand. I think I'm going to go for the, frankly, really pretty ridiculous way we started with equivalence of technology in LMP1, that we knew before those cars hit the track that it wasn't anywhere close, that we saw it from the first moments on track that they weren't close, and that still nothing was actually done to equalize, and that we have suffered the better part of the season with things only now beginning to get to the stage where we've got any level of true competition in LMP1. I think that's, frankly, in the situation we currently are with LMP1, where we know that we've got that machinery for at least another season, and beyond that, probably they're going to be grandfathered into a season beyond that. I don't think that was smart. Whatever deal was done, it was a bad deal for the sports, and I think people are beginning to realize that. Obviously, look, that's my answer on that one.
And we're trying to do one question, one answer, so this will be tiny voice in brackets, so in theory I'm not offering a second here, but if I were to offer one, it might be the announcement that Success Ballast is coming to the World Endurance Championship. What an embarrassment of a failure of imagination. Let's go to our pal Retrowavosaurus. Let's see. Hype of the year. This could be retrospective or looking forward. Which teams or drivers got you the most hyped during 2018 or 2019 and why? I just wrote about this, so I feel bad like I'm almost just parroting what I just wrote on racer.com, but
are you pimping your own work? How dare you, sir?
Well, it went up, I think, yesterday or the day before, so it's already kind of run its course traffic wise.
Would that be on racer.com?
I believe that might be a particular news outlet that has been a long-standing client. I'll be starting my 7th year with them in just
fantastic.
A matter of days. How lovely. I would say two things. Core Autosport revitalized IMSA's prototype category this year after coming so close and becoming, by about mid-season, a week-in, week-out story to follow. Can they topple the entire DPI field? They came up one DPI short, but that really, for me, got me hyped. And I would also say Catherine Legg's efforts, almost, I don't want to say solo efforts. She obviously had teammates. It was a revolving cast, though, but Catherine Legg's attempts to win the GTD title effectively on her own, since she was the only driver earning points at every round. And also the fact that the team was only planning to do the first couple of races. There wasn't funding to do more. But when they got through the first couple and found that, hey, we're sitting right up towards the pointy end of the championship standings, we can't go now. We can't leave now. And they kept looking for money, kept finding it. And that was just really exciting. At least for me, Graham, hashtag me personally, when I think of sports car championships, it's often about big teams and factory type stuff, and those are the big standout points of the season. I would say the Pro-Am core team and, you know, Cat trying to win the title in the Pro-Am GTD category, boy, that just turned the entire season upside down for me. We might be verging towards Graham being the grumpy guy in this episode, but we'll go for it, and I'll pose this one to you. This comes in from M.W. Clarkson. I know you read my question out on this a few weeks ago, but I can't let, quote, bitter gall of the year go. So what rates is Graham Goodwin's bitter gall of the year event or happening?
Two moments in the...
You just got them right there. I mean, it's just bubbling up, that bitter, that vinegar taste in your mouth.
It is absolutely two of them, two. Both at the 2018 Le Mans 24 Hours, it was the first turn incident that saw the damaged front section of bodywork effectively ruin the race almost before it had started for one of the rebellions, and it was much later in the race for another LMP1 car, and it was Jenson Button not making it to the end on 24 Hours with a engine failure. I seem to remember on 23 Hours, I think that's right. And I'll add a third, which was the moment that must have had hearts sinking in the fantastic, the epic GT Pro field, which was the moment where the factory Porsche effectively got a lap on the field with a caution very early on in the race. And from that point forward, everybody knew it was going to be one hell of a long day, one hell of a long night, and one hell of a long day afterwards to no great avail, because that thing was ironclad, reliable, and quick, and it absolutely didn't need the leg up it got. That was the bitter gall.
Let's see. Ruben Nacha asks, most controversial moment of the year? Actually, throws in three questions. I'll take the most controversial one. I still come back to the Rolex 24 Daytona in January and the decision to penalize the Monoplast by Land Motorsports Audi number 29 Audi R8 LMS GT3 that had figured out a faster way to refuel their vehicles through optimizing their fuel cells, something I've worked on in the past many times with various teams. I get the concept behind it. Hey, there was an implied expectation of how fast everyone would refuel their vehicles. Your cars were significantly faster and done fueling sooner. I get the mindset of wanting to create parity in the race. I still think, guys, you might not have liked it, but they found a loophole in the rules, made it work for them. I believe, could have won the race, or would have at least put themselves in a position to win the race had they not been penalized. Following the event, this is always the telltale sign, Graham. After the race, IMSA then implemented official expectations of minimum refueling times, essentially minimum time sitting still on pit lane while refueling. That wasn't in place going into the Rolex 24. The team, therefore, did not have to adhere to it. So that, to me, when you come up post-race with a rule to firm up a decision you made in the race, that you had to rely upon the quote, you know, in the best interests of the sport, or it's always worded somewhat differently, but there's always some sort of get out. If we feel something's happening that's not in our best interest, we can penalize you or make a change. The fact that they had to rely on that instead of an actual written rule, that just tells me, sorry guys, this team got you. This team beat you at your own game, and you had to pull out a wild card to get them back. I wasn't a fan of that.
No, I think it's interesting, isn't it? I know we've had a further reference somewhere else to these three separate, completely different fuel fill controversies. You've referenced one, the Dempsey Proton one. There was the, of course, TS Racing and G-Drive Racing incident that cost them their Le Mans 24 Hours win. And oddly enough, I think there's a sliding scale. I think you're absolutely right. The rule was not there. Then all of a sudden it was. That's not the way you run any kind of fair sporting competition. You've got a rule book. If someone's found a way around that rule book, however unfair an advantage, that loophole was there for anybody to exploit that chose to do it. You've then got the G-Drive TDS one where, well, they didn't make a great deal of a secret about the fact that they were doing it and were prepared to defend that on the basis of this is our interpretation of the rule book. That's worse. But it's not as bad as what Dempsey Proton got caught for, and that was just blatantly cheating and then trying to bluff their way out of it at the end of it. So three, on the face of it, similar incidents, but three completely different levels for me. Let's have a look at the next one. Let's go for... it's another Travasaurus question. Which driver, in our point of views, me personally, has grown as a driver, maybe in terms of our own imaginary driver rankings, mentions here Gidio Perfetti for the Project One team in WEC's GT Am class. I'm going to go for a young man I've spoken about before. I think he's on his way up, and he's on his way up stratospherically, and that is going to be Huub van Uytvet. A young Dutch driver that was a standout talent in LMP3. I think that's a very difficult thing to do when you've got such a spec competition. And I think his pace at times really rattled a few of the kind of coming pros in the European Le Mans Series, the Michelin Le Mans Cup. And watch that young man, because you're going to be seeing a lot of him in a lot of different places, in a lot of different cars, and at least one of them, I'm sure, is going to be challenging for race wins on the very biggest stages. So Huub van Uytvet, for me, is the person who grew as a driver, already talented, made his mistakes in the early to mid part of the season, but then from then on in, anchored his team home for a title in the European Le Mans Series.
Let me throw this in, just because I think it might add some interesting color that maybe not every listener or sports car fan is aware of how these relationships work. So I wrote towards the end of the year after Felipe Nasr and Eric Curran won the IMSA Prototype Championship, had referred to Eric, now two-time champion, won again in 2016 with Dane Cameron, wrote about him being a gentleman driver and such, and got a fairly nasty email from him, and I've known Eric for a long time, so, you know, that part wasn't bad. But got a fairly nasty email from him saying, hey man, what is all this kind of dressing down of me as a gentleman driver and you kind of painting things as a, you know, wow, look how far he's come kind of thing. And we had a call afterwards and explained to him that, you know, I know, knowing where you came from, that you didn't start driving till you were racing till you were like 25 years old, which is fairly ancient for someone who's, you know, I don't even think he's 40 yet, but got a late start, wasn't someone who grew up in go-karts, and had to work his way up through toiling through a lot of lower tin top categories and such, has gotten to the point where he got into Daytona Prototype, was well off the pace, was clearly a definite am, and worked with mentors, worked with pro co-drivers, got better, and has become someone who, getting back to the primary question here in terms of growth, is someone who, while we would not put him up against a Felipe Albuquerque or Ricky Taylor head to head and expect Eric to win in equal equipment, he's someone who, you know, might be a tenth or two off, 3/10 at most, but he can hang. It's an amazing progression. And the conversation we had was, and Eric threw this back and said, and I completely agree, he said, well, don't you think there's something that we should be referring to, come up with a term, Graham, that is between a gentleman, kind of pro-am driver, and a pro?
Sportsman. It's been around for a while. We've often called them sportsman drivers. It came in the 675 era, where you've got those guys. I mean, Simon Dolan in Europe was an excellent example of that. In his pomp, actually, Mike Newton too, who was just quick, not quite pro quick. And I'll have Simon on the phone telling me that he was quicker than naming a number of pros at any point when he's downloaded this one. But sportsman driver, I think, covers it beautifully, which is that's someone who not just aspires to be, but grows into something more than someone who turns up at a weekend and just does this for shits and giggles.
And so I'd throw Eric Kern in here, and this isn't specifically 2018 growth, just we've seen this trajectory for him. Has been phenomenal, and I hate the fact that he is now stepping back into more of a part-time role, but nonetheless, if I think of someone at least modern that has really gone from a, oh, cool, he's running, you know, little Chevy Cobalt front-wheel drive thingies and little touring car series to, wow, this guy has given the business to Jordan Taylor during this 2-hour-long stint at wherever, you know, pick some other big name and go, hey, he's either leading them and holding the lead or close the gap. I mean, just something where you go, boy, if you'd watched where he started, you would have never have guessed he would have gotten this far. So huge respect to him. You know, I'm going to go to one other question here from our pal Trevasaurus. And this is maybe, Graham, a... covering off something, and as we go into the new year, knowing that this is our final episode of 2018 and we're just past the half hour mark, I think this is going to be an executive decision. The question is, what was the best, brackets worst, misinformation from various sports car outlets, only to be debunked a matter of days or even hours later? We do our best here, to be honest. I think it's fairly clear that there's a particular site and a particular site owner that we just have no time for, and who, if we're talking in the misinformation, has made a steady habit of posting a variety of nonsensical things, and then since they own the site, go back and delete them when they're proven to be false, rather than standing up and really just wanting to take ownership of their work. So I know that might not answer the direct question, and I'm not answering it directly because I don't really want to or have the interest in, but I think with the just proven lack of lots of things, I think, Graham, this will be the last time we reference that outlet, yeah, that person. I think going forward, I mean, I ignore them completely in person, and so I think let's just really make a nice clean break here in the final episode of the year and say, you know what, if we're going to talk about other sports car news, whatever outlets, it's going to be ones that we respect, ones that we say, hey, that person's
doing great
work. That
sounds,
work.
Like a resolution.
Does that sound like just a positive? I mean, and again, this is trying to turn something that while the outlet here in reference is one where it's just a constant head shaking of wow. I'd say let's just break through into something positive, man. Let's just say, hey, we're good. We're going forward. Misinformation, misinformation, someone that's actively working to post stuff that says what you write in particular is false and wrong. You know what? Let's just leave. let's just leave the nonsense. We're going to leave that in 2018, move forward to 2019.
It's a detoxing moment, mate. It's a detoxing moment.
It's just, look, It's not as if what you and I do is going to change the world. It's not as if anything anyone does writing about motor racing is curing cancer, solving world hunger. I'll just say that in this case, there are many fine people. We've mentioned them before, from Marcus Schurig to Gary Watkins to Stephen Smith, Stephen Cole Smith to blah, blah, blah. There are many fine people. Andrew Cotton, who do fine work to cover sports car racing.
I've never heard of any of them.
Well, they've never heard of any of us. There's Stephen Kilby on your end. There's all kinds. There's you. There's a lot of great people who I can just look at and say, positive contributions, no nonsense, and someone whose work I would be happy to point other towards, even if it takes away from traffic or interest in mine. So let's just embrace those of us that you and I embrace in our actual day-to-day jobs when we see them, and who I think are held up in esteem. So how about that? That's a positive thing. All right. Hey, Happy New Year. Where should we go next, my friend?
Where are we? Okay, let's try for Creeping Cold, the best uncrowned performance of the year. Is that one for you, MP?
No, that's for you.
Is it? Let's have a think. I'm going to go for a team that's got used to winning, didn't win this year, or at least hasn't won so far this season. Still got some chances to do in Asia, but didn't win a title or indeed an automatic entry for the Le Mans 24 Hours in the European Le Mans Series. That's United Autosports. And their coming man in sports car racing, Philip Hansen. A young man who showed well on both sides of the Atlantic.
Good call.
Was far from embarrassed by two lofty co-drivers at the Rolex 24 Hours, Fernando Alonso and Lando Norris. For it was they, but from that point forward, just went stratospheric and has been as quick as anybody else out there, including as quick as his own co-driver, Juan Felipe Albuquerque, or Paul de Resta, and deserved to take something other than race wins away. They did get race wins, but did not get what they were looking for, which was either a title or indeed that automatic entry. That's why we've still got United Autosports, you know, banging heads over in Asia. But that, for me, was the best uncrowned performance of the year, though that is going to be another young man and another team that we're going to see some fantastic stuff from in the very near future.
All right, let's see. And now I am going to start working through the, we have three times as many questions as we can get to in the less than half hour remaining on the old clock. How about Tom Neal, who says, how about a worst award? Worst official decision by a sporting body. Well, we could say that IMSA's decision to present me with an annual hard card delivering access to their events.
Well, one more time.
Oof, and I just got another one. So, it is consistent poor decision-making on IMSA's part. I don't know, mate. Is there... Well, I already mentioned the land penalty at the Rolex 24.
I'll give you one immediately. No, I think it's another IMSA one, and I think it is their upgrading of Madison Snow. I think that was not a smart decision.
Sorry, IMSA. I'm not trying to pick on you, but there are a couple of dingers. Okay, this one's going to be yours to answer. And I would also implore, I mentioned this on the podcast Facebook page, I would really appreciate if one of you or maybe a few of you kind of banded together, you know, behind the scenes and take each one of you take a different week and jot down a document the words, the new words that I create each week. And I leave in. You do realize I could edit these out and try and sound super smart, but I don't. It's an accurate representation of who I am. James Counter, in terms of awards, asks for the best word created by MP. My vote is for last week's, quote, pronounce, P-R-O-N-U-N-C-E. Pronounce, yes, I did say that. Please, can we have an MP dictionary?
You can't do better than a wrong, a misspeaking of pronunciation, can you?
No, but there is. And this isn't related to the week in sports cars, but this is a genuine thing. I think I've mentioned it before, who knows when. I was, again, I'm just being honest with you here. I must have been 6 or 7. I don't know. Was that a little, used to call them five and dime, little convenience store with my mom. And I think there was a new issue of Mad Magazine. And I opened it and was looking through it. I used to love Mad Magazine. And this is when my mother just looked down upon me with both disappointment and realization that her son would need a lot of extra tutoring. I looked at a word and said, Mom, what does idoit mean? And she said something along the lines of, do you mean idiot? And I looked at it and realized that, and this does actually go, I'm not making this sound like it's a major thing, but I do have, I guess you could say, a very mild version of dyslexia. So I, again, in the word idiot, which I think I did clearly see the I before the O, but however it worked out, those letters got swapped around. And yeah, looking up to my mother and saying, what does idoit mean? And just seeing that look in her eyes like, holy, did I smoke too many cigarettes while I was pregnant? Did I drink too much? What did I do? And realize that, yes, her idiot son could not actually pronounce idiot correctly. So yes, there's a treasure trove of this stuff. I'm hoping someone starts documenting them because, yeah, that might be a standalone episode at the end of next year, Graham, if someone's kind enough to do that. Why don't you grab the next one, my friend?
I'm going to grab the worst interview of the year. That, for me, was my attempt to interview Chip Ganassi at the Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona.
What happened?
It was short. It was not very informative. It ended badly.
Oh, well... yeah, Chip can do that way, can be that way sometimes. I'm going to grab one other one quickly here, also from James Counter. Best piece of journalism of the year. I would say, and I can't, again, this is, it's not as if I've read everything everyone has written and then have divined down the best, but the one thing that stands out to me that deserves consideration would be my friend Stephen Cole Smith's story with Hurley Haywood. Very early in the year, I believe it was on Auto Week, and this is in advance of Hurley's autobiography, where a wonderfully written story, very powerful, but also in print, the first time that Hurley came out and told the world that he has been and was indeed a gay man. And I'm just thinking of all the things one could write. There's lots of flowery prose and beautiful wordsmithery that folks have done in sports car racing this year, but I would say in terms of impactful, Stephen really, really aced that one. Thought it was a very important piece that should, in theory, Graham, stand long beyond just a sports car racing story produced in 2018.
Absolutely. Tad Gabron basically asked for the best, most far-fetched untruth heard in the paddock this past season. For me, happened not that long ago, and the story came my way, that Blancpain were to leave the SRO fold. That was, well, the source it came from was fairly credible. The story, though, was completely incorrect. And indeed, if anything, there's just been a further strengthening of that that link between the two organizations, the Swiss watchmaker and Stefan Rattel's organization. Did what I usually do with those things, put it in a notebook, thought about it, went and asked some other people, got slapped about verbally a little, and forgot it until that question was just asked. And thank you very much for that, Tad.
Eric Harkrader says, best Christoph Buschu reference. We had a couple, but I don't know if we've fully gotten in, excuse me, to the Christoph Buschu experience. And that will involve grabbing some drivers who have
I know a few.
Okay, well, go for it.
Well, I can remember one which came, I think, testing in Monza. This is some time ago, and it was one Mr. Bob Berridge. Fine gentleman and very tall, Bob. Christoph, not so tall. There was some kind of argy-bargy on track between Bob in, I think, his LMP1 Lola And Christoph, who, if memory serves, was in a GT1 Lamborghini, and I think it was contact a test, and I seem to recall it was Monza. That might be wrong. And all I can tell you is that, so the story goes, Bob got out the car at the end of his stint and was approached in the pit lane by Mr. Bushu carrying a hammer. And the exchange with Bob towering, I think I'm right, almost 2 feet above Mr. Bushu, looking down upon him and telling him to off.
Yes.
Off.
Flavor himself off.
At which point he did. But yes.
Yeah. Let's go to our dear friend, and we have had fun all year long. Thank you. Seriously, for being one of our just most joyful contributors, that being Shay Adam, who throws in three. Time to fully acknowledge the Canadian American excellence that is Shay Adam. She throws in three questions here. I'll pose the first and maybe even answer the first. Best non-winning drive of the year. I'm still going to come back to Mazda.
Yes.
So close to winning at the track that they sponsored for 17 years or whatever it was, formerly Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. I would say, boy, they certainly had that race in hand. I know it was a little bit fortuitous, right? We had a couple of the Action Express cars in trouble with a big start line crash that was epically dumb. But if you just look at a team that, boy, had a race, clearly dominant, no one was going to touch them, and then it all went completely sideways, despite what Gustavo Yakimin and his father want me to believe. I would say Mazda coming so close at Laguna to winning their first race with the DPI and then not winning. How about we go to Nathan Brown for you, Graham. Best underdog win of 2018 in a GT or touring car?
Well, that's a good one, isn't it? I don't think there's been that many. I guess the one that springs immediately to mind, just because it's very tough in any class to come into an established grid and do well, would be the opening race of the European Le Mans Series season. And it's a team that we've had hanging around the fringes for some time, but back in sports car racing after 20 years away. It's the Racing Engineering team from Spain. And they won first time out. Didn't win again that season, but with a very good driver squad, an excellent pit crew, and coming out of GP2/F2 and now into LMP2. And I think we're going to see bigger and better things from that team coming forward to win, and to win against a very deep grid indeed of LMP2 cars. We had something like 15 or 16 that time, with a couple of the WEC teams turning out, and at a track that they will not have known that well, certainly not in their brand new Orica. I thought there was an exceptional performance from them, and it did signal intent that we've got another serious player in a field which I think is going to be grazing 20 LMP2 cars next year.
I believe Serious Player was also the name of the gentleman strip club you worked at in college, Mr. Goodwin. So
they'd be wrong there, because I never went to college.
Let's see. Sean
explains a lot, doesn't it?
Well, I guess those are the lies you have to put on the employment form. Surprise, even have a form for a male strip club, but good on you. We'll go to Sean Caldwell next. Now, I was about to say Nest, which is a word, so I didn't make one up, but I did use the wrong one. Sean Caldwell, best pass of the year. What comes to mind, my friend?
That is a cracking question.
I might suggest, I don't know if it's best, but again, it should be in the conversation. I would say the delightful number 99 Gainsco sponsored JDC Miller Motorsports Red Dragon at Watkins Glen on the run up to the bus stop. They went on to
win. That was a cracker, wasn't it?
Yeah. Ooh, and you were there. I was not, unfortunately.
That was,
that was a bit of a stunner in the turning of the tides of it being another DPI whitewash of the season to, maybe this isn't going to be as predictable.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the great thing about that pass, not only was it a great pass, not only was it actually unexpected at that moment, but it turned the tables completely. We've been looking at the United Auto Sports Ligier, the core Orica, both of which looked to have it within their grasp to take that race. And what we weren't looking at was the next one down, which was the Gainsco-backed Orica from JDC Miller. And yeah, what a cracker. You're absolutely spot on. That was a blinder, wasn't it?
Indeed. Well, let me take a look at the old clockety clock here. We're maybe 10 minutes or so to go, something in that range. So I would say we need to mash the throttle a little bit, but maybe pick and choose the ones that really stand out to you, my friend.
Let's go for most ridiculous press release of the year from Brian Cohen. I think it's not the only one. We've had another one asking around that one from Jonathan Schultz, the best worst PR statements. I think regular listeners will be fully aware that I'm not massively keen on things to do with balance and performance. I'm certainly not very keen on things happening in the middle of a race meeting. But I'm going to bang that drum again one more time, which is, if you're going to put out a technical bulletin, please try and explain it to us. Because if you're doing it in the middle of a competitive session, which happened on one occasion at Fuji, then we haven't got time to process what's going in out of the window, what's going on the timing screens, and then interpret correctly what actually this very complicated series of numbers you're throwing at us actually is going to mean in terms of time on the track. So for me, it is general comment, and it is please, sports car racing technocrats, will you please take the 5 minutes of your time to put two paragraphs in to explain to the wider audience, which you and we are trying to engage on your behalf commercially, to just explain what it is you're trying to achieve, so that way when the comment inevitably comes, it's just a tad more informed.
I will throw this in quickly. I don't recall if it was an actual press release, Graham, or if it was just statements made to the press, but at this year's Rolex 24 Daytona, when in the prototype class we had very worrying and very consistent tire failures.
Yes.
There were some statements made by Continental Tire that implied I'll leave that open to interpretation, that a lot of the failures were due to teams and incorrect camber settings and not heeding the tire manufacturer's recommendations. And then we had an instance where Wayne Taylor Racing actually withdrew from the event due to the repeated failures. I think they'd gone through all their rear bodywork. And then sat down with Continental, where, again, they were part of the, quote, accused, and went through all of their data, where it showed that, no, indeed, every single parameter has been met, has not been exceeded. We have been within tolerance on everything. And there was then a bit of a walking back of the finger pointing.
I tend to agree with that. You and I were both a part of that exchange. Let's have a quick look. Biggest improvement from a team driver from 2017 to 2018. That comes from our question of the week asker last week, Alex Eichmann.
Well, I just answered the last one, so I think I'm going to throw it right back at you, my friend.
Biggest improvement, team and driver. Well, I've already mentioned young Philip Hansen. I think that's a big improvement. Pechito Lopez, I think, deserves a mention. He's come into his sweet spot aboard the Totas this year and has played a full part, something I think would have been difficult to actually have said last year. Well, most improved. I think I'm going to go for Pechito Lopez or Marco Sorensen in the Aston Martin racing team. Now, Marco very much has been in the shadow of his fellow Dane teammate Nicky Team, but has become a bit of an Iron Man, and that's been great to see. And he's now there and stands four square with the other stars in Aston Martin racing. Johnny Adam, a coming man as well. Nicky Team, absolutely. Alex Lynn, new to the team and will surely go better and faster. But I'm going to go, I think, on reflection, for Marco Sorensen from Aston Martin Racing.
I'm going to go to Patrick Thomas. Apologies in advance for an obvious response. Best least remembered moment of 2018. I don't remember. Yeah, exactly. My apologies there. Let's see. Our pal Ryan Terpstra sent in many options for us here. The Alan McNish Award, awarded to the driver who did the dumbest thing and made up for it. I would have to go with Harry Tinknell, who was definitely, I believe, more carried more of the blame in that race-losing incident at WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca on Mazda's behalf. And then rocked up at Petit Le Mans and put in just an event-long worth of shining stints that could not be beaten, that topped everyone in the entire grid. Or was he at the WEC race? Sorry, it's a little bit of humor intended right there, Mr. Goodwin. I got the first part. I don't know. Tell me that there's something from here. I read that. I knew I was waiting for that one. Oh, man. I'm hoping you can tell me about maybe a WEC drive from young Harry with the Ford GT team where you'd say, okay, he made up for it. I'm not saying the timeline would work. It might have been before the Laguna incident. But, yeah, was there something Harry did that we can at least dig him out of this hole a little bit?
Harry's a star, and he's a lovely, lovely bloke with it, by the way. And one thing about Harry is if you put a microphone underneath his just to him once he's just got out the car, the adrenaline is still flowing. And he's like Harry Tinknell and Alex Brundle. I think there must be some genetics there because they've both got this same utterly pumped up post-stint adrenaline-fueled hyperdrive that goes on there. Never a dull moment from Harry Tinknell. We saw some fantastic stints through the year from Harry in the Ford GT, which is a remarkable car in that either seems to be untouchable or absolutely nowhere. Whether or not that's to do with the window of operation with balance performance, whether or not that's to do with temperature and the tyres, which we've seen before. Thing is, you've got to find the ones who've sort of messed up and then kind of come back and done something spectacularly wonderful. There's not been many, you know. There's not.
Let's see. I'll grab this one quickly, and then we've got a bunch of livery questions, too, we should get to, or maybe sum them up in one. Peter Bester, the best, quote, why did they bother to turn up award? I have to pick, and I love these guys, so it's not trying to pick on them, but I would say the Bar One Motorsports team that turned up at Daytona with the X, what was it, Le Mans or Keating Motorsports, Riley Multimatic Mark 30 spec P2 car, despite an off season of work to try and improve that and some quote jokery upgrades, they might have been better off getting a GT3 car and slapping a prototype labeling on it, because the speeds were not that far apart. And yeah, that car just was never going to be competitive, unfortunately. The race didn't last that long for them, which I guess is good in one sense. But I also feel bad, Peter, because it was such a poor showing that they didn't turn up again. And we haven't seen them back. We hope we're going to see them back. But yeah, one of those things where not only was the car so bad and so slow that the race was poor, but I think it might have taken them out of the conversation for others who might have viewed them as a team to sign up with for future events.
That knits beautifully in with not Carmen Jorda, great name, by the way, and the own goal of the year. And I'll go with the choice by Ginetta to go with the Mechachrome engine. And for that matter, the choice that they made to go a long way down the line with, frankly, a commercial proposition that just was not going to deliver the goods. And we get to see what the net result is going to be for the Ginetta LMP1 program, the G60 LMP1 program. But certainly early doors, it looks like we spoke last week, MP, about the Toro Track hybrid system for Nissan. For me, they went too far down the road with an engine that just was not producing enough ponies, and realized just a little too late, I'm afraid, that they'd gone down a little bit of a cul-de-sac.
All right, let's get to a livery question or two. We are at our approximate 1 hour timeline here, coming up super, super quick. Chris Alphaby, who I hope I didn't murder your last name, best livery. Actually, what he wrote was best livery noff. LiveRynof. Hey, our listeners are making up words.
Yeah, can we go with the quote words now?
I am infectious. I love it. Best livery of the year, full season. And again, we've got a bunch of similar, you know, best livery of the year, one you would want to dress your car in, best or worst looking cars of the year. You're certainly a spotter of liveries. So give us your best, GG, and maybe is there one where you would say, go work on it some more.
I give you most improved. The change that Porsche made this year, I think, did make those cars pop. And of course, we had a couple of one-off liveries, or three separate one-off liveries with the heritage liveries on the cars, Petit Le Mans and at Le Mans, which were all geniusly done. I'm going to give a mention simply because it looked utterly different to the Ginetta, because that blue and white on the cars really looked very, very good indeed. And when I saw them actually building up the first car in the factory before the car was unveiled at the Autosport show in January, that was the first time I'd not seen it as a render. That was the first time I'd actually seen the car being put together with its full livery on. It was kind of, wow, that looks really, really good. So I'm going to go for that. There have been a number of very good-looking cars this year. There's a couple of LMP2 cars in the European Le Mans series. Decade Engineering's car and the black base scheme looked really good. For that matter, I quite like the Konica Minolta livery on the Cadillac DPI. I think that one looks pretty good. And the wheeling coveries colours always look very good indeed. But, you know, just purely because we give them a slap with one hand, we give them a loving caress with the other, I'm going to go for the Ginetta's blue and white.
I'll throw in the counter to that, the best one-off liveries. And so I think Porsche's GTE Pro, Retro Pink Pig, and Rothman's liveries, those really struck home for me. Just love those. And I think I'm off. It wasn't a one-off. I think it would have been a two-off or whatever off. But got to give a lot of love to our pal Andy Blackmore and his Chupacabra P1 Motorsports Mercedes AMG GT3. And funnily enough, I just had a calendar, a 2019 calendar show up from dear Andrew of the Chupacabra. So yeah, lots of love to him and great call by the team, right? Let's just have some fun.
Yeah,
tell I like fun with my motor racing. All right, brother, we're starting to straddle into overtime. We got a couple of questions left. I'll throw this to you, RJ O'Connell, because you can answer this better than me for sure. Best Japan thing of the year.
It's an easy one, and it's a car that we're not going to see going into 2019, retired at the end of this season. It is the least likely car to have a massive fan base, I think, on the planet, and it's the APR Racing Toyota Prius with the road car based hybrid system and the XLMP1 V8 engine. It's all changed because they're no longer allowing the engine configuration the car actually featured this year. So there will be a new car for 2019, but that thing just had a massive, enthusiastic fan base, and when you saw it, it looked a little bit homespun in exactly the way that you and I have discussed repeatedly on this show is missing from the world of motorsport now. But then when you heard it and you watched how this thing went, what a head-turning little car that was. Absolutely fantastic stuff.
Okay, just taking a quick poke around here, and I know you told me to stop doing that. It does hurt.
Yes, please.
Okay, Bonnie_last47, best version of the garbling of a certain lady pit reporter's name by the Twisk presenters.
Never said anything at all wrong about.
No idea what you're referring to, Bonnie, no. Or Shaia Adam. Was it the Dutch?
Oh, because you said lady. It's Shay. Sorry.
Oh.
Shay.
Is this the Dutch Punjabi chocolatier we referenced earlier in the year? Shaia Adam? Or sometimes I get lost. There was also a question. I don't see it in here. I think you were being just far too kind of the best English co-host of a weekly sports car show with an American that has a cartoon depicting the two of them award. I'm going to give that one to Stephen Kilby, for sure. Even though he hasn't been on the show, and even though he is your subordinate, as he should be.
He's not as good-looking as me, either.
No, not at all. I'm going to give that one to Graham Goodwin. Okay, I did a recount. That one's going to go to Graham Goodwin. You are definitely the best in that category.
Let's finish this one off with... and there's lots of people who have asked these questions in various ways. But one very quick one. The worst background noise during an interview. Ray Mingleby, by the way.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I do my best here to work around the expected noise issues. But we have, just outside of our little condo here, we have folks that turn up in the morning and regularly either... cut the grass, use the big weed and grass blower and such, and they tend to show up at about the same time, but sometimes they surprise me, so I'll schedule a podcast and think, okay, I've got a little bit of silence, and then you hear in the background, and I'm trying to do my best, and it's like, oh man, again, my wife and I are hoping to move somewhere different, and for me at least, big part of that thought process is, where can I find a place that I can kind of have silence whatever I need? So, yeah, that's one of them. The other one might be... Nah, that would be mean. I was just going to say, there's some people with some very loud or annoying voices in many media centers where you're like, would you just shut up? Also realizing that there are surely many others, while you and I, or just me specifically, hashtag me personally,
yep,
are happen to be interviewing someone, and they're saying, would you just shut up, Pruitt? So it's a mutual assured destruction. We're all loud and annoying in some way, and we all wish one another would shut up or die. So
let's finish it with this, because there are questions, and apologies, I'm trying to scroll down and find the names, for the best and the worst interview of 2018. And for this one, I'm going to take a step all the way back. I want to say congratulations on the progress you've made with the Marshall Pruitt podcast this year. Congratulations on blowing through 2 million downloads and continuing onwards. You've spoken to some awesome people. I actually had lunch with my good friend and ex-colleague, Malcolm Cracknell, who not in great health at the moment, but introduced him to your podcast. And he's now downloading an awful lot of them. So it's been a big comfort to him, I think, over Christmas and into the new year. So the best and the worst for the Marshall Pruitt podcast and those interviews, MP. To finish us for 2018.
Well, best. It's not sports cars, but it is now. It wasn't when I did the interview originally, but it is now. And that would be Ricardo Juncos, who is an IndyCar team owner, Road to Indy team owner, championship winner on the Road to Indy, and is now an IMSA DPI entrant. His story from May during one of our Day at the Indy 500 podcasts, where we normally did about 10 or 15 minutes on those. Graham just grabbed a driver, engineer, team owner, whatever, and just spoke about the day. Grabbed Ricardo for this, and we turned it into a semi, my racing life and career, and just his story of coming from Argentina after a huge recession with the American dream story of almost no money in his pocket, a very small loan, I believe, from his grandmother, which he made him pay back to get to Miami, built himself up just working as a mechanic in the karting scene, then started his own kart team. Just truly this beautiful immigrant story, which is what we all are here in the United States, despite some who believe immigrants are bad. Listening to Ricardo's story of coming here with nothing and looking at him now with this massive shop in Speedway, Indiana, being represented across IndyCar, Indy Lights, the second tier Pro Mazda series, and now IMSA. That was my favorite interview of the year. The worst, and I have to apologize. Actually, I don't have to apologize. Just I feel bad because I'm keen on him. That would be 1987 IMSA GTP Drivers Champion Chip Robinson. I really like Chip. I actually just had to interview him last week as well. And Chip is someone blessed, Graham, with skills that involve hands on steering wheel, feet on pedals, and shifty things. Word talking, mouth usage, word saying in interview form, not so good. I did one interview with him, in September, where it was a bit of a reflection piece with a lot of voices. The interview was so bad, I just didn't use it. And so that's kind of a first. And then when I had to speak with Chip last week, it was just one of those lots of dead air and silence. You know this, and everybody who's a reporter knows this. You might have seen this on television at some point or heard it on the radio, where an interviewer asks a question. It doesn't even have to be good, just a general question. Tell me about this thing at this time. And you get back three words or something similar. It is a reporter, an interviewer's worst nightmare. Hey, so tell me, you just hopped out of the car. How are the conditions? You go, okay. Really? You think I've been standing here for 10 minutes waiting for your monkey ass to get out of the car to ask you that question to have you say, it's okay. I could just say that on my own. There's some folks who kind of understand conversation and the give and take and trying to be generous in that capacity. So as much as I love and appreciate Chip for all that he has achieved in the sport, just definitely not one to do a lot when interviewed. So, or maybe it's me. Maybe I suck and he is awesome with others. That's always the other option.
He rang me. We had a brilliant chat. He said you were terrible.
Good. Good.
Well, I'm going to say my farewells for the year, Marshall. And I want to say again, thank you to you for actually suggesting that we do this madness every week. And it's a thoroughly entertaining kind of interlude in my week every week. Thank you particularly to our listeners, and in particular to those of our listeners, the increasing numbers through increasing parts of the internet. That's the Reddit groups on the WC side. Thank you guys, the USCR side and the Blancpain side, to the guys on Facebook, on the FIWC fan group page, the new Sports Car Worldwide page, also contributing now, and to, of course, our regular contributors via Twitter. You keep us busy, and we couldn't be happier, and it is carrying this forward. And I think it's fair to say, MP, there's some exciting stuff to come, and not that long to wait.
And not only am I in full agreement, we're not obscenely over the one-hour limit. We kind of vaguely, not exactly, but a little bit stuck to our plan. I'm so happy.
Wow.
I'm so happy. The
It'll never happen again.
Pruitt time maybe is falling closer to real-world time. So on that, Mr. Goodwin, thank you for being awesome. To you all, dear listeners, and those of you who also take the added time to send in questions via Reddit, via Facebook, and via Twitter, thank you so much. I'm so happy as well, Graham, that we shifted the format of the show to a listener-driven construct. We are going to continue doing that. We might add in something a little different next year for following major events, where we might start off with a little bit of back and forth. What did you like? What did you dislike about the event? Major highlights, just things. Sometimes, by chance, the questions you send in might not cover some of the things that occur to us. So we might add in a little bit of the back and forth to open next year on certain episodes. But by and large, just really want to thank you again and again. And also want to thank Cooper Tires for helping to make this Week in Sports Cars experiment that began the first week of February into something that, boy, we love it. And we appreciate your help in making it grow. So with that, Mr. Goodwin, why don't you take us home for the year?
Happy New Year, everybody. I hope you've had a brilliant Christmas with those you love close to you. I certainly have, and I hope you have too, Marshall. Everybody listening in knows it's been a hell of a year on a whole range of fronts. It has been for us here in the Goodwin household too. We're coming through kicking, we're coming through smiling, and you, my friend, I will see in just a few weeks' time in Daytona after you've seen Stephen Kilby at the Roar.
Well, I'm now canceling my trip to the Roar because Stephen Kilby will be there. All right, gang, thanks all for listening in. Truly enjoy a happy new year, and we will speak to you next week.